The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MICU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have a lot in store for us today these next couple hours. We're going to start with a conversation about railroads and the African-American experience, an incredible story, an incredible book with his author, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, before Courtney and I tell you a bit about your public radio station, WEAA, we've got to turn this over to traffic, WEAA traffic, that is, and get you home safe and come right back to the conversation. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are about to have a conversation with Ted Kornweibel, who is a historian, author of the book Railroads and the African-American Experience, A Photographic Journey. He's a San Diego State University Emeritus Professor of African-American History. This book, when I first saw it, I said, oh, what a lovely coffee table book. But it is way more than a coffee table book. And Ted Kornweibel, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
And you all can join us out there at 410-319-8888. You may have a familial history with the railroads, your own thoughts and questions as we have this conversation unfold. So please join us here at 410-319-8888. Ted, this history is fascinating on a number of levels. But, you know, whenever most Americans, no matter who we are, think of African Americans and railroads, we always think of Pullman car porters.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just like the surface of the story. I mean, it's an important story, but the history of African Americans and the railroads really is a history of how America got built, but also a history of how the civil rights struggle and the black movement and black middle class got built.
Mm-hmm.
It's all that. Talk a bit about how the take us back into the pre-Civil War era and the story of how the entire railroad network in the South was built by slaves.
Well, you just said it well. The railroad network of the South was built by slaves. The South didn't have a ready supply of exploitable white immigrant workers like the Irish were used in the North. Lots of slave owners had surplus slaves, sometimes for the entire year, sometimes for a month or two before the harvest, and they would rent them out to railroads, to construction contractors. And many of them were used in construction, but once the railroads were constructed, most of those railroads continued to rely on black labor for maintaining the tracks, for being firemen and brakemen, laborers, some even skilled workers, mechanics in the shops. So you find African Americans enslaved all over the South in many different roles before the Civil War.
You begin this book really with taking us there. When they first, the introduction to the book, the preface is about a woman named Rose, and it gives you a fairly honest and brutal portrait of what that was like.
Well, Rose was a woman who was a house servant in a somewhat urban environment, but her owner got a construction contract to build a portion of railway between Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia. And so poor Rose was sent from the upland South, where she could buy fresh vegetables, perhaps grew some in the garden, cooked for the family, and there she was, isolated, the only woman among a track gang, or construction production gang, cooking with heavy crude utensils, having only the very basics, flour and molasses, coffee and sugar, and isolated, sexually vulnerable.
And one of the things that that Rose's story pops up, the story that pops up with Rose, that you go on to explain later in the book, is that while Rose was a cook, I mean, the railroads in the South, and even in post-slavery era, were built by black women as well as black men doing backbreaking work.
That is the untold, until now, the untold story, that if you read most general works on railroad history that mention women at all, they'll say that the first women railroaders were about 1855. They worked on the Baltimore and Ohio between Washington and Baltimore, probably cleaning stations and doing that kind of custodial work. Well, 25 years before that, or 20 years before that, rather, black women began to be used sometimes as construction laborers, expected to do the same amount of work as men. And that's not surprising because the southern canals that were dug earlier in the 19th century, sometimes up to a third of the construction workers digging those canals were women. So the South had indicated already its willingness to disregard any gender differences, to assign women to work that black women to work at jobs that white women would never be considered for doing.
We're talking with Ted Kornweibel, who's a retired professor of African American history from San Diego State, and he's written an incredible book called Railroads in the African American Experience, A Photographic Journey. Number is 410-319-8888. You know, this book looks like a coffee table book, but it's really a work of history. Mm-hmm. and it's you went and researched this incredible images. I mean, the images in here are just amazing that you've plucked out of our history. But it's more than that. It's also the history that you have unearthed that has not been known before. I mean, this whole idea was not known before. I've never read it anywhere else. Whether it's been about the role of women who in slavery who helped build the railroads, to the power of the railroads and industrial machine, where most black folks got their work not in steel mills. These are stories that we don't hear, that we don't know.
Yes, there's and it was a story that I didn't know 20 years ago. I've been teaching African American history for over 35 years. And if you had asked me before I started work on this, what was the industry, not talking about agriculture or domestic service, but what industry employed the most blacks over time or at any given time, certainly up to the 1940s? And I couldn't have said railroads. I might have guessed iron and steel, coal mining, or something like that. It's never been highlighted that railroads were the number one, the most important, the most numerous jobs in industry for African Americans for decades and decades.
410-319-8888 to join in on our conversation with Ted Kornweibel about the railroads and the African American Experience, A Photographic Journey. And I mean, one of the things you do here, though, I love the way you put this book together, is not just the incredible photographs and paintings that you put together here and the stories. We'll talk a bit about the role of culture and music and the battle for civil rights. But you see this through the eyes, lives, words, and worlds of real people, whether it's Rose or people like Alan Brown, who we'll talk about in a few minutes, or E.C. McLaughlin. You come up with people that we don't know in history, and you paint our history through their eyes.
Well, that was the joy of research for this project, because there was a source of rich data, biographical data, family data, educational and social data about black railroaders that had never been used and really not much used to tell stories of white railroaders, and that is the Railroads Employee Magazines, monthly magazines. Sometimes these issues were 80, 90 pages. They were big magazines, chock full of biographical details, obituaries, retirements, or just interesting people. And in the South, every railroad employee magazine always identified who was black with a C in parenthesis for colored. So there's no difficulty in using those magazines to uncover the rich, rich lives of black railroaders.
We're going to take a short break and talk about the importance to support your public radio here, WEAA. And we'll be returned to Ted Corden Weibel in his book, Railroads and the African American Experience. Stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're here with Ted Corden Weibel, who has written this incredible book, Railroads and the African-American Experience. Number here is 410-319-8888 to have your questions answered and comments about this piece of our history. And also you can use that number to make your pledge at 410-319-8888. Ted, picking up where you left off, I mean, let's talk about some of these people that you've written about. Like Alan Brown, Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad.
Well, I'm going to have to confess there's so many people that that I wrote about that I'm not remembering Alan Brown specifically.
Alan Brown, he was the guy you wrote about who worked on the maintenance department in the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad for 42 years.
Oh, yeah.
And you talk a lot about the retirement and how these folks in many ways were honored on many levels, but what they went through and how long they actually worked in these railroads.
Well, every railroad by the 1920s, major railroad, had a veterans or an employee, long-time employee organization, and if you worked for 50 years, you got a gold pin or a diamond pin. If you worked for 25 years, you got maybe a silver pin. And blacks were awarded those honors for longevity. But what is so painful in those stories is that the job ceiling was so rigid that you could work for 50 years and get no higher than when you started as a track maintenance worker, as a brakeman, as a fireman. There just was no prospect of moving into the skilled crafts and the prestige crafts, which white unions insisted on reserving for whites, and the railroad companies compliantly went along with it. So there weren't black conductors, there weren't black engineers, because those were white men's jobs and reserved for them exclusively.
410-319-8888, as we talk with Ted Corden Weibel about his book, Railroads and the African American Experience, A Photographic Journey. And one of the things that it's so interesting how we kind of remember but don't remember certain things, that we talk about how the slaves built the railroads in the South. It would not have been built. And how we look at that most people own just a few slaves, but the railroads actually, some railroads actually own slaves.
That's right.
To do the work themselves.
That's right. It was not the most typical, because by the time railroads got built, they had invested a lot of capital in buying up property, the right-of-way, erecting buildings, putting in track, and all of the supporting structures. So most railroads in the South rented slaves because they didn't have the capital to buy them. But some, in fact, did buy slaves, sometimes even families of slaves, finding work presumably for older children, probably as water boys or as station cleaners, something like that. But they wouldn't have bought them if there was no economic value to it.
And the other stage of this was post Civil War was the role that in the South, especially that black prison labor played in the construction of our railroads in this country.
Well, that's one of the most shameful chapters in Southern history, and that's the infamous convict lease system, where the jails of and prisons of the Southern states were emptied by leasing those prisoners out to construction contractors, building railroads, to sometimes coal mines, and to railroads themselves. And their longevity or their death rate, put it that way, was higher than it had been for blacks during slavery, because the railroads had bought them or got their labor for a year so cheaply that if one died, you got another.
410-319-8888. We talk about the history of African Americans in the building the railroads of America, and as you look at this history, though, I mean, one of the things that really was astounding to me was, you know, we read a great deal about the returning World War II veterans as being the being part of the root and the power that built a modern civil rights movement, but we also, until I read this book, never kind of really thought about what it meant for the working men and women of the railroads and the role they played in fighting for civil rights in America.
Yeah, a half century or more before the civil rights era that we know, blacks were trying to organize themselves as unions because they weren't admitted to the white unions, and to try and collectively improve their working conditions. They were largely unsuccessful in it, but the fact that early in the 20th century there were unions of Pullman porters before the famous Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. There were unions for other crafts. Black workers were among the militants in the half century before the civil rights movement, and when the civil rights movement began, let's say in the mid 1950s, the dean, the elder statesman of civil rights, was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, A. Philip Randolph.
Right. And the battles went even before that. I mean, you have a piece in here about what happened in the South like around World War One, when there were black men who were firemen on the railroad. You'll explain what that is in a minute. But that they were in this battle with the white firemen who didn't want them to be allowed on the Illinois Central and other railroads to work in the yard. I mean, this was just one example of many of the battles that split the workers over race.
And it's also an example of how the illogic of racism, a job that is defined as a black man's job at one time, may then later become a white man's job, may revert back to a black man's job. Briefly, what happened with the firemen and on quite a number of railroads in the South, by World War One, two things made the job of locomotive fireman, that's the person who slung shovelfuls of coal, tons per hour, into the firebox of steam locomotives. The wages were increased when the federal government took control of the railroads during World War One and decreed that didn't matter what your race was, if you were doing the same job, white fireman, black fireman, you were to be paid the same. At the same time, there was an innovation called mechanical stokers, which was a screw mechanism that brought coal from the tender and deposited into the firebox, so there was much less heavy shoveling. And so whites now came to covet those jobs for blacks, and in a number of instances resorted to assassinations, to terror campaigns, to drive blacks out.
And it also, there's a kind of sidebar history in all this. I mean that one of the few jobs for a long time that black folks were allowed to have on the railroads in the 19th century and into the 20th century was that of brakeman, because it was a job where you could die.
It certainly was. The highest death and accident rate of any among railroaders was the brakemen, who, before modern air brakes, they had to skip from car top to car top when the engineer blew the whistle signal for applying the brakes and mechanically, physically turn a brake wheel to help a train slow down, let's say, on a downgrade. The engineer would then sound a whistle for releasing brakes. They'd have to reverse the pattern, and they died falling off the cars. You had to be up there in a snowstorm at night, in the rain, the sleet, and it was a dangerous job, and blacks could be paid less than whites. that the railroad soon discovered that it was to their advantage to pay less to blacks, A, because it saved money, and B, because it created antagonism between white and black workers and prevented any kind of labor solidarity across the color line.
We'll take a short break. When we do, when we come back, we're going to talk about how the black brakemen lost their jobs, even during the Roosevelt era, to the white brakemen, and how that happened and why that happened. We're going to talk about the reality of John Henry, who was not just a myth. He was a real human being, what that story was about. We're going to look at many of the factors in this in terms of music, the art, and more that's in this incredible book as we talk with Ted Cordenweibel about his incredible book, Railroads and the African-American Experience. We'll be right back. On the way to this break, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state, the number is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking this hour with Ted Cordenweibel, who's written this really amazing book. I mean, Railroads and the African-American Experience. As soon as I saw the book, I said, you know, this is a nice coffee table book. And then I took the book home and started reading and went, oh, my God, this is a serious history about a very serious subject that we do not know about and we need to know about. 410-319-8888. When we left off, Ted, I mean, one of the interesting things here, many interesting things in this book, is that in the 20th century, we think of the Roosevelt era as a progressive era, and so many people in the black community backing Franklin Delano Roosevelt when they could vote in the North, and loving Eleanor Roosevelt, and the civil rights movement was growing then, but it was during that movement that there were real setbacks to black folks who were working on the railroad.
That's right, and it's because of the politics of the era. For Roosevelt to get anything big passed, like Social Security, he had to bow to the wishes and the racism of the powerful Southern white Democratic congressmen and senators who controlled the key committees. So that's why Social Security initially didn't cover any agricultural workers, because powerful whites in the South wanted to keep black workers vulnerable and exploitable. So the legislation that helped many people unionize during the New Deal made it almost impossible for blacks to form unions that had any power at all, because only one union was allowed to represent an entire craft. Only one union for firemen, one union for brakemen. And so blacks might form their independent unions, but the railroads were under no obligation to even listen to, sit down, discuss with those unions. So blacks in those fields, like brakemen and firemen, they were represented by white unions, represented in quotes, white unions whose objective it was, there was a lot of unemployment, to drive those very blacks out of those jobs and open up jobs for whites.
I have to ask this question, Ted. I mean, where these photographs in this book are just amazing, from the 19th century and from the earliest 20th century, of black female work gangs, of people in Cornelia, Georgia, in a labor gang. I mean, they're just amazing photographs. I mean, and where did you find these? How did you find this treasure trove?
Well, that was the joy of the research. I found those in probably 36 or more libraries and archives and historical societies, but I also bought on eBay quite a number of the photographs, and it's surprising what you find on eBay. It's surprising who you end up bidding against, but some of the the pictures that I treasure most are ones I got on eBay. I'd love to hear from readers what their favorite photographs are. So if any of you have the book or get the book, write me, and I'd like to discuss that with you.
Well, that'd be great. And by the way, this book was published by Johns Hopkins University Press. 410-319-8888 is the number here to ask questions and to pledge. You can do one or the other or both. And Stephanie in Catonsville, you're on the air.
Hi, I was I've missed a portion of your show.
That's
but
all right.
I'm really fascinated by this topic, and I had read a book once, Fast Food Nation, and the author brought to light the fact that the car industry and the tire making industry had conspired a while ago to put the railroad out of business, basically. And they were also found guilty by the Supreme Court eventually. I think the trial went up to the Supreme Court. They were only fined $1, but I was wondering if your author was aware of this and how he thinks that may have impacted the civil rights movement and interrupted the social network and the communication network that the railroad system may have supplied for the black workers.
Well, there's quite a controversy among railroad historians over the degree to which the automobile industry and the rubber industry bought up not railroads but streetcar systems
right.
in the various towns and cities, then closed them down to create a mass market for automobiles as well as for secondarily for buses. And there's some evidence to show that. You know, the civil rights connection to black railroaders is direct. The first successful national black union was the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and it took them over 10 years to finally force the Pullman Company into sitting down to negotiate and ultimately to sign an improved contract, and not just for the Pullman porters, but the Pullman maids as well. The leadership that developed in that labor, but also civil rights struggle, continued to be important during the World War II era and up to the beginnings, at least, of the civil rights era. That the March on Washington movement during World War II was inspired and led by A. Philip Randolph. It had many sleeping car porters backing it in Montgomery, Alabama. The key person in the local civil rights community was not Martin Luther King. It was a Pullman porter. So there are many examples of the heritage of militancy that grew out of black railroading and black railroad activism.
Stephanie, thanks for your call. You also have some very interesting cultural aspects to this book as well. I mean, the short piece on John Henry, who was a fable about the powerfully built black man on the railroads who beat out a local machines in line and track, but he was actually a real human being.
That is one of the most fascinating stories I've come across in a long time. How often does someone who's always believed to be mythical turns out to have been a real person? And there's a new book, the author Scott Nelson, I forget the exact title, but he's uncovered that John Henry was in fact a Northerner, a Union Army veteran. He stayed in the South after the Civil War. What his offense was that got him into prison, but then soon out on the convict lease, I'm not sure what that was. He died with many others in construction accidents, cave-ins, tunnel collapses, or either just overwork, brutal treatment, poor food, non-existent medical care. All of these reasons made the convict lease so deadly. And just about every detail in the traditional ballad of John Henry has some validity to it. So it's a marvelous story of uncovering a real person that we always thought was just a mythic character.
Yeah, that I had no idea. I mean, I never that until I read this book. It was just, it was always a tale you heard. And remember, I have a picture on my wall as a kid that I had of John Henry, and here he was a real human being. I mean, before we go to break here, I'm curious, give us one other thing that really grabs you as in your research that you had no idea existed about black folks in American railroad history that you kind of blew you away.
Well, one thing that blows me away is the fact that status and worth in the black community didn't depend on the color of your collar, because very few blacks had anything close to a white-collar job. It came from a steady income and from becoming community leaders. And it shouldn't be astonishing to find that many career black railroaders, now we're not talking about the so-called boomers who worked for a few months and lived in construction camps or converted boxcars and led a pretty wild and dissolute life, but those who were career people who had families, they were pillars to build the black middle class. And we know that because there's rich detail in those employee magazines about people. They celebrated their children's graduations from high school and especially from college. If they bought property, that was often noted in a report in the magazines. If they had a good crop in their gardens, that was noted. If they were church deacons or officers in the Masonic Lodge, that was noted. And again, we see these career black railroaders as being solid citizens. And in many towns, the most of the black leadership.
We are talking in a really fascinating conversation about a piece of our history that is He Helped on Earth, Railroads and the African-American Experience by Ted Kornweibel. And we'll be back with our conversation with Ted in just a moment. I will remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Stay with us. We have to talk a little bit about your public radio in your life, WEAA. Welcome back. I'm talking with Ted Kornweibel, who wrote the book Railroads and the African-American Experience, A Photographic Journey. The number is 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation and to make your pledge. Ted, I want to go back to where we left off. We talked about John Henry, the brakeman, but one of the things that you talk about in here, I mean, this, I was thinking about the juxtaposition of a couple of things you wrote about. One is the symbolism of the railroad, of trains in African-American life, is deep and profound. And it covers everything from the dream of getting out of slavery to coming to the North to making a living and in the music. I mean, and you really kind of laid it out in a number of levels here.
Well, we begin with the Underground Railroad. By the time that was really a flourishing enterprise in the last decade or so of slavery, widespread throughout Southern black life and culture. The railroad had already come to symbolize movement and escape and freedom. And once slavery ended, black migrations began and didn't stop, really, for over 100 years. And the railroads made that possible. There are stories about people who were just idling away at a train station and saw a train about ready to leave with black folks on it and inviting them to come on up north with us. And they hopped on. And we see that reflected in the blues. We see railroads as the path to opportunity, but also railroads breaking up families, breaking up love affairs. So the imagery is really rich. It's multifaceted.
And you have an entire chapter here, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, but we talked about it mostly in terms of the role that women played in slavery. But you have an entire chapter on black women as railroad workers. Again, an unknown chapter of our American history.
And if I can just give a little sidelight to that.
Please do.
When I first published that little bit of research in a journal, historical journal, there were railroad historians who complained that they weren't really railroaders.
Oh.
That tells you the myopia and, frankly, the racism.
Racism and sexism combined.
In railroad history. It was during the World Wars, both World Wars, that women of all races were brought more centrally into railroading. But black women were deemed appropriate for the harder, more physical, more outdoor jobs than white women were. So most of the women who contributed to railroading in the World Wars worked on tracks. They were in the roundhouses cleaning and polishing locomotives. They were cleaning coaches and Pullman cars, doing their bit. We know of Rosie the Riveter. Well, it was Rosie the Railroader as well.
I love this one little story you have in here. I think in that section about black women in the railroads, of Ida B. Wells, the incredible African-American leader and educator, who, when she was a 21-year-old school teacher, in 1884 refused to be carried back to the smoking lounge. that's a great story.
It is, and it's great because it's not the only example.
Right.
Of women who challenged segregation, challenged racism, sometimes at the in Ida B. Wells' case, risk of being thrown off the train or being manhandled. But there are some very, very heroic stories of people protesting against segregation. Segregation was not just imposed on the railroads. The railroads accepted it because it reflected Southern white norms. And so for decades, blacks protested pretty futilely for many decades against the indignities of segregation. And the Jim Crow car came to symbolize that. The Jim Crow car was usually an older car, usually more dirty, hadn't been cleaned as well as the white cars. The Jim Crow car was always the first passenger car behind the steam locomotive, which meant that it got more cinders, more smoke, more dust coming in. In later times, those Jim Crow cars were still open window cars, while the nicer air-conditioned cars back were reserved for whites. So one of the greatest indignities that brewed and led blacks ultimately to the militant civil rights era was the experience, the indignity, the humiliation, and sometimes the physical manhandling of blacks having to ride segregated.
And I must say we're almost have a few minutes left here, Ted. But I mean, you have this entire chapter on music and the railroads and the blues and jazz, and it's just an amazing chapter. And the stories about the struggles in the 20th century, and the positive images you have in this book of black people who worked in the railroads, and even the photographic images. I mean, you have all that in here. This is just, to me, it may look like a coffee table book, but this is a pretty groundbreaking book you've written here.
Well, I appreciate the compliment, and you're right. The photographs and images can be appreciated on their own just thumbing through the book. Each chapter is kind of a standalone essay, so
yes.
You don't have to read the book from start to finish. You can pick it up, and it's my hope that African-American readers of the book will want to explore their own railroad heritage. I'll go out on a limb and say that there isn't a black family that doesn't somewhere back in its ancestry have railroaders.
This has just been a really wonderful talk to you. When you come to if you ever come to Baltimore, D.C., you've got to look us up and come by the station and come by the show again. And it's really been a pleasure to have you on the air with us.
I'd love to, Mark. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you so much. Ted Kornweibel, his book, Railroads and the African-American Experience, A Photographic Journey. I want to encourage you all now to call 410-319-8888. Make a pledge of $100 or more and allow us to give you this book as our present to you for supporting WEAA. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. This April's issue hits the office with stories about jobs in the city. Features include a look back at Baltimore's past with a portrait of the lives of steelworkers in Sparrows Point during the post-war boom, as well as a conversation with urban development guru Ted Howard, who has a plan for putting Rust Belt cities back to work. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a complete list of magazine pickup locations. I'm Mark Steiner for WEAA Baltimore. We'll be right back.